Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we will have a number of guests. We will have Rabbi Yosef Weiner. He's the Rav of Kehillas Shara Shamayim in Muncie. He's the Mechaber of many Sfarim for Art Scroll, and he has over 800 shiurim on TorahStream.org. We will also have Rav Goyen Rav Nachum Eisenstein, who is the Mishamish of Rabbi Yashiv for over 30 years, and he's a big Rav today in Eretz Yisrael. He sits on the exclusive, the Geirus Bez dinner that Rabbi Yashiv found, that he's the head of that Geirus Bez dinner, and he is one of the premier Paiskim of Gittin in Eretz Yisrael, and he will be talking about Hafgas Gittin and the recent, quote-unquote, Hafgas Get that happened here in America with the famous Epstein case in Philadelphia. Additionally, we'll have a few other guests playing small parts, cameo parts. You're listening to us on our news station, WSNR, 620 AM. You're also listening to us at WMCA 570 or at WMCA.com or on the Nachum Segal Network at NachumSegal.com. Before we begin our program, I just wanted to say a small thought, like I always do. You know, I had the opportunity, Rabbi Mati Sushar, of Gateways, he asked me to speak in front of the Google, the space mission. They have a group in Israel that they are trying to put some type of an unmanned craft on the moon. And they're doing it with a bunch of really, really bright Israeli tech guys. So they came to the brownstone, that's Mati Sushard's building, Akira building in the village, and there were like 200 people there, and he said, I want to have, since I'm a Kirov organization, I want to have at least one religious person say one Torah thought before they begin, and he asked me to get up and say something. So this is the thought I conveyed, and tell me what you think. So I said, you know, how does Avraham meet God? The great founder of three religions, of monotheism, Abraham, how does he find God? So the Medrash says a story. It says he saw a palace burning. And he looked around and he said, where is the owner of the palace, this burning palace? And he looked and he wondered, and it says God appears to him and says to Abraham, oh, it's my palace, and starts a conversation, a dialogue with Avraham. So I have a question. You know, all these medrashim, they're metaphors and they're stories and they're many layered, they're multi-layered. And my question to you is, whose palace was it really? And remember, in the Middle East, they make everything out of stone. What do you mean it was burning? I mean, they didn't use wood, so what was on fire? Now, who built this palace? And I think it's a metaphor. Avraham, our great forefather, he was a great humanitarian. We see that. He invited guests constantly. He worried about humankind. And he was a philosopher, the first monotheist. So he looks at the world, this great mind, and he says, ecologically, look at the world. What do you have? Drought, hurricanes, ecologically, disease, Ebola, cancer, the avian flu. It's a mess, ecologically. Geopolitically, what do you have? War, terrorism, genocide, huge migration of people through war. What do you have culturally? Misogyny. Look what's going on in the United States today with racism, molestation, on a personal level, divorce, suicide, anxiety, depression. He looks at the world and he says, who made such a crazy world? Where are you, God? That's Avram's question. So he sees a bira. He sees a palace burning. What is the palace? The palace is the beautiful world that we live in. It's on fire. You know, the Kotzker Rebbe says that when the Gemara wants to say an amazing question, it says, Marid Avram, Lord of Avram. So the Kotzker Rebbe says, why does it say Marid Avram? He says, because Avram asked the greatest question ever. Where is the Baal HaBira? Where are you? So there's different answers. Some religions answer, you know, the Stoics, the Buddhists, they say suffering is in your mind. The Gnostics, suffering is in your mind. If Descartes, you are what you think. If you don't think of the suffering, it doesn't affect you. Well, tell that to a kid who's lost his parents, who's lonely, who's crying, he's missing his mother, somebody who's hungry, suffering is in your mind. There are others that say, you know, in the kingdom of heaven, there will be only good. The day is coming when suffering will cease and evil will be judged. Augustine. At the end of time, all will be resolved. Well, Abraham looks at this and he says, that's wonderful, but who wants to wait? How many millennia for this to happen? That doesn't make me feel good over here. So he's wondering. He says, where are you, God? So what does the Medrash say? Hashem comes back to Avraham and he says, where is God? He says, I have a question for you. Where is man? I created a world that's 90% done, 80% done. And yes, it has issues. And I left those issues for you to partner with me and fix and complete. So when something goes wrong, I say, where is man? Where are you? You're supposed to be my partner in all of this. And that's a quintessential attitude, a Jewish attitude. You see a problem? What can I do to try to resolve, to relieve somebody's suffering, to help somebody in pain? That is the answer that Avram said. That is our challenge. And I'd like to jump on the line and give an example of somebody who's taken this message to heart and has made it their work to say, I want to do Avram's mission. How can I make the world? How can I partner with the Rabbeinu Shalom and relieve suffering and be a shutif b'maisa b'reishis with Hashem to make the world, to finish that little piece so that we are now co-partners? So we were speaking about how the Rabbeinu Shalom, how God, when he created the world, he was looking for a partner. Mitchilas b'riyasei shaloylam nesaveh kadosh baruch hu lasei shutfis betachtayinim. He was looking for partners here because he really created a very flawed world. And he was looking for people who would help fix the broken. And which is why Avram Avinu, he was the first one, the bris, which is brisei shel Avram, is on the eighth day. Because the Rabbeinu Shalom says, I created the world in 7 days. And Avram says, the eighth day is where Adam, where man steps in to fix and complete the world that the Rabbeinu Shalom created. So I want to introduce you to two people who are two partners with the Rabbeinu Shalom in fixing the broken of the world. An amazing couple, Rabbi and Mrs. Rube, who formed an organization called Pillars. And Pillars is, their motif is to take orphans, people who lost a mother, a father, or both, children or teenagers, till they're married, and they sort of ensconce them in love and home and teaching and events to help them through this very tremulous, traumatic time. Welcome, Rabbi and Rebbetzin Rube.
Thank you very much, Rabbi David. It's great for having us on.
So tell the Olam a little bit about this amazing organization, and maybe you can share one or two stories with us.
Okay. I'm hoping that my wife at some point will start to talk, but until then...
I'm here.
Okay, wonderful. Like you're saying, the idea of partnering up with the Rabbeinu Shalom, it's definitely... that's definitely a task, and it's something that we hope that the Rabbeinu Shalom is very happy with what we're doing. I would put forth, I suppose, that what we do and what we hope to accomplish with them is sort of what you were just saying, is that people that are broken, they feel very often because of the loss that they've gone through that they're alone in the world, and because of that they feel that they can't really accomplish much. So what we end up doing is that we've basically put forth a system throughout the year. My wife will be able to discuss that much more at length, which is that the girls have to end up going through a place where they feel comfortable, that they've gone through, they're in an area where there are other people that have also gone through a loss or a similar loss, and yet they have managed to accomplish and to become great people, and that our goal for them is that they should have that comfortable zone where not only that they get together, but at the same time they're capable of getting better, to be able to get closer to Hashem and live very happy, healthy lives.
And how many children do you have at any given time?
At any given time, well, we just had a Shabbaton this past week. We had 75 Yesaimis there over the Shabbos. Overall, I think over the entire organization, starting from the youngest division all the way through, I think my wife has the numbers better. It's, I think, 170 girls about.
So tell me, Mrs. Rube, tell me of a story of somebody whose life you've impacted.
Okay, so, you know, I have so many different stories. I'm thinking of one story now, only because this story has repeated itself over the years. This story happened like right after our first Shabbaton. And, well, actually at the Shabbaton, at our first Shabbaton that we made several years ago, there was a girl who came from a very hard family situation. Not only did she lose her parent, and I'm going to refrain from giving details because I want to protect their privacy. So this girl had a very hard family situation, and she took a tremendous amount of responsibility toward her family. And she felt that she would never be able to get married because how would her mother manage if she would, you know, once she got married, how would she be able to help take care of all her siblings?
She had no mother or no father? Which one?
She had no father. She had lost her father. And again, there are so many details to the story, but I'm not going to, I'm not going to divulge any of that. So she had lost her father, and she was a tremendous help at home. There was a really hard family situation, let's put it that way. In addition to losing her father, there was a lot going on at home. So she took a tremendous amount of responsibility. And again, she didn't want to get married. And I'll never forget, my husband, you know, stood there with her over Shabbos. She had gone over to, you know, that's what happens over Shabbos. They come over sometimes to get some guidance, just to talk. And my husband had given her such beautiful advice. He said, of course you're helping out tremendously at home, but do you realize that if you got married, what a beautiful bracha would be for your family, how much simcha you would bring into the home by, you know, finding your, by having a husband and coming over to the house and visiting. It would just be, you'd be bringing in so much more simcha and creating normalcy in your home by having, by the fact that you're married, happily married, and how much nachas you'd bring to your mother. And it was just so beautiful how right at that minute she made up her mind, she's ready to get married. And it wasn't too long after that she started dating, she got married. And I'll never forget going to her chasana. It was just so beautiful. She saw me, she came running to me. She hugged me so tight, she wouldn't let go. And I felt her tears just coming down. And she said, Shana, I would not have been able to get married without pillars. There was no way, and I attribute, and she wouldn't let go. I just, you know, that's like an image that I'll never forget. But the interesting thing is that this very similar story, obviously different situations, have repeated itself so much over the years. Like how many chasanas I've been to from these girls, and Baruch Hashem, they get married, and I go to the chasanas, and again, their faces light up when they see us, and so many of them attribute this healthy place that they finally come to Baruch Hashem in their life to us, because this whole program is one of growth and just so much of, you know, helping them get to that healthy place from where they were.
And Rabbi Rube, could you share an experience that you've had over the years with some of the girls who, the orphans who you've helped?
Well, I have to be honest. I'm there on the Shabbatons. My wife is really, the reason why it's called Pillars is because she's the pillar. She is the one that is there dealing with the girls always on the one-on-one basis, going to all of the places themselves. Me personally, I'm there on the Shabbaton, so I do get to talk to the girls. I don't really have that personal, close relationship where they're going to end up confiding in with me about how much it means to them. They always do that back to Shoshana.
Do you have a lot of kallahs?
Baruch Hashem. We had like 30 this past year, which is incredible. It's just so incredible. We had like 30, and being that Pillars is like a family, every time there's another chasana, it's another family simcha. It's just so, so special. It really, really is. I mean, I have so many stories I can think of. You know, I know time is limited. There's just so much to say on it.
So let me ask you a question. When you do a Shabbaton, and you're surrounded by 70 of these Yesaimis, and you feel all the love and everything you're doing, do you feel like you're a partner with God?
100%.
Totally.
I truly believe that we felt like, it sounds nutty to say, but we felt like the Shekhinah is there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. It's not often that I have a chance to talk to the Rabbeinu Shalom's partners. Thank you for coming on to our show.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to our main topic tonight, which is going to be discussing the terrorism that's going ongoing in Eretz Yisrael and how to deal with the fallen terrorists. Do you give him the second shot or not? Let's go to the telephone. We have the honor of having with us Rav Hagaon Rav Yosef Weiner, the Rav of Kehillas Shaar HaShamayim in Muncie. He's mechaber many sfarim for Art Scroll, and he has over 800 shiurim on TorahStream.org. Welcome, Rav Weiner.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we have a very current topic, both in the United States and in America and in Israel. And here's the topic. So you have a terrorist. He runs into a crowd and he stabs somebody. And we've seen videos like this all the time. And a guard, there's some standing bystander, pulls out a gun, shoots the terrorist. Terrorist falls down, drops the knife, and he's standing there incapacitated. Well, here's the question. You have two choices. You could shoot him again and just be done with it. Or you call the police, they take him to the hospital, $100,000 of care later, he's released into prison, he's put into prison, he gets a life sentence. You know, sooner or later they catch an Israeli prisoner, an Israeli soldier or civilian, it's inevitable. They release 1,000 terrorists for one prisoner, and this guy's back out on the street. Is it 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, we don't know. So do you do the second shot, or do you let him expire? Now, why do I mention that it's relevant in the United States, too? Because just today, in fact, an hour ago, an article crossed the newswire in the New York Times. It's going to be front page tomorrow's New York Times. And that is, when the United States captured Osama bin Laden, when they killed Osama bin Laden. So there was a debate in the White House. Well, it's the middle of the night. He's going to be in bed. You're going to charge into the room. Do you shoot him or do you allow him to surrender? So four attorneys wrote a brief, and it was the New York Times describes it as the most confidential brief written in America. These attorneys said, don't ask questions, shoot him. But they also seem to imply that if he absolutely surrenders before you have that opportunity, and there is nobody around him who looks threatening, it would be very problematic, and they made provisions to get him on board a ship, etc. In other words, don't ask questions, shoot him. But if he would absolutely surrender, they could not come up with a solution. So this is clearly a very problem in law. So here we have the same situation here. The fellow's lying there in his blood. He's incapacitated. His knife is out. Rabbi Weiner, give us a halachic opinion. What would you say?
Okay, let me give a few disclaimers. Obviously, this is probably one of the most sensitive topics you could discuss in general, certainly on the radio. So whatever we say will be part of the discussion. And when the Ramat Kal calls me for my definitive psak, I will brief him then. Until then,
I think what you're saying is it's for discussion purposes only.
That's correct. That's correct. Just one chilek before we even lay out the two possibilities. Bin Laden, had he been captured alive, would no longer be a status of a roidif because he would be taken to America to stand trial, and b'derech hateva, in the natural sequence of events, he would never pose a danger to anybody because they're not letting him go and they're not letting him out. Unfortunately, your average terrorist in the street is up for political maneuvering, and down the line, after he spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and he gets another education in jail on how to be even more fanatical in his ways, they will let him out, and he is a clear and present danger to society. So in terms of the recent news, bin Laden would not be an analogy. Let me go to a few examples in Navi, which is really the best source to start with, because David HaMelech, as you know, fought many, many battles. And I'd like to try to figure out from a few of these sources, what is the fallback position, if I may, if there's no other consideration, what do you do with a POW? In Malachim Bey's Perek Vav, there's a very fascinating miracle that Elisha does, among many miracles that are recounted there, where Melech Aram sends an army to capture Elisha. Elisha wakes up in the morning. He's surrounded by hundreds of thousands of soldiers. He asks Hashem to smite them all with temporary blindness, takes them all, almost humorous, marches them into the capital, into Shomron, presents them to the king. They're now surrounded by the Jewish army. He says, Hashem, please open their eyes. And the Melech Yisrael is standing there, and he says, and I'll quote the pasuk, Vayomer Melech Yisrael, Elisha, Grosa, Sama, Aka, Aka, Ovi. Should I kill them now? Should I eliminate them? Listen carefully to the answer. Elisha says, Vayomer Loisake, Ha'asher, Shavisa, Becharbecha, Bekashtecha, Atamake. Those who you captured fair and square in war, there are two ways to learn this, but one could read the pasuk, you have a right to eliminate. This was done al derech neis. It was miraculous. It wasn't your doing. Rather, I have a better idea. Sim lechem amayim lefneim v'yoch l'v'yishtu v'yoch el adoneim. This is a very important pasuk because his idea is, A, you shouldn't kill them. We'll go back to that in a moment. B, if you really want peace, why don't you give them some chont and kugel and gefilte fish? Send them back. They'll learn the lesson of how friendly we are and that we really want peace. They'll tell the king, and they won't show up for a while. And interestingly enough, that was a call, a political call, Das Terah, and he was right. We don't hear from Aram. We hear from them right away in the next parak, but it was Achare. It was after a while, and apparently they got a few decades of peace out of that. What was Elisha telling him? Is he telling him that you can never eliminate prisoners of war, or was he merely saying, over here, you shouldn't for two reasons. Reason number one, you didn't capture them. It was a nice. Reason number two, over here, we've had so many battles and so much terrorist activity from Aram. I think we should try a new method. Make them happy, show them we're friendly, and they won't come back right away, which actually worked in that time. Obviously, an ongoing discussion the last few decades in the Middle East. If we try to be friendly and we show them we're interested in peace, will it help? Unfortunately, at this point, it does not, because it doesn't look like we have partners. But Ba'asher Husham, in that particular political situation, Elisha decided that was the best thing to do, and he had Siyata Deshmaya. If you look at the Rishonim on the Pasuk, Rashi says, Ha'asher Shavisa, V'chidarkecha Larag Oisem Sh'atamavi Shaviyah. Rashi leaves it sort of open, like, do you always kill POWs? Like, what for? You capture them, let them go. Sounds like the fallback position is not to eliminate them. You look at the Ralbach, he says that quite clearly. He says two things. Elu Shavisa v'na'akti b'amkoch gvuras Hashem. These people who were captured by Hashem, you shouldn't hit them. Ha'em taka anashem asher tanai b'shevi b'char b'char b'hashtacha. Do you normally kill them? Ein zeroi. Fallback position is not to kill them if it's not necessary. V'kol shekein, certainly shein roi ze b'asher shavo sam Hashem yisbarach. And certainly over here that it was miraculous.
Geneva Convention, basically.
Yes, yes. Basically, Rashi and the Ralbag. And again, Geneva Convention is interesting interjection because in the ancient world, it was quite common to get rid of the combatants so they shouldn't come back and kill more people. Ralbag and Rashi seem to be saying that over here, it certainly shouldn't be done because it was derech neis, and we can now sue for peace. And it worked. And besides which, it's not a good idea in general as regular policy. If you look at the Metzudas David and the Radak, they clearly say the opposite. Both of them say in this pasuk, I'll read to you the Lashon of the Metzudas David, Ha'asher Shavisa, Ha'im Aim, Asher Shavisa Ata. Did you capture them? You didn't capture them. Shataka Behem Halo Benesu, for they were brought here by miracle. So it's not your doing, you have no right to kill them. Obviously, the clear indication is that had this been a regular battle, al pi derech hateva, and a natural sequence of events, he would have the right to eliminate them if he sees fit. The Radak says the same thing. You didn't kill them. You didn't capture them. You have no right to kill them. Ma'din yesh l'cha behem shataka sam chiyata shavisa sam b'char b'cha b'hashcha. Did you capture them with your own might? You did not, and therefore you shouldn't kill them again. The diak over here is that the fallback position is that if it's necessary, and if you feel it's prudent, you can eliminate them. So here we seem to have a somewhat of a dispute in the Mefarshim what that fallback position is. If you look at the Rambam and Hilchos Malachim, Halacha Lamaisa and Perek Vav, the Rambam says that we should always sue for peace. If you go even on the offensive, ask them, tell them we're coming, warn them. We're fighting wars with Siyat Deshmaya. We ask the Arvatum. We ask the Sanhedrin. We have the luxury of letting them know we're coming, which in conventional warfare is not done. Let them know. Tell them we're coming in. We just want you to keep the Zion mitzvahs, the seven mitzvahs, which you're supposed to keep anyway.
Even on a Moloch.
Even on a Moloch, the Rambam holds that if they surrender and do tshuva, you don't have to kill them. The Ravid argues, but the Rambam says yes. Even on a Moloch, certainly by the seven nations, when they came to Eretz Yisrael, we are not interested in killing anybody. L'sachayek kol neshamas, only after they didn't surrender. One nation was smart and left. The other one tricked them afterwards, the Gevonim, and everybody else fought. Which
the Rashi argues by a Moloch in the Zionam, but that's what she disarmed them.
Right. And the Ravid argues also. And the Rambam, in his introduction to regular warfare, says that if they accept the seven mitzvahs and they accept the taxation and the jobs they have to do, everything will be fine. The Rambam.
So what's your point to here?
So my point in the Rambam is, and I'll read to you just two lines: Vim lo eshlima osha eshlima v'lo kiblu seven mitzvahs. They didn't keep the agreement. Oisim em bachama v'hargim kol zchar magadolim. Not the women, not the children. The Rambam clearly says you have the right to eliminate the enemy combatants. It's not clear 100% for the Rambam. Is that during the battle or afterwards? It sounds like it's all inclusive. So, in summary, I believe that there is ample evidence. There are definitely Rishayim who hold. You can eliminate them because if they came to fight, they are dangerous and they will be dangerous next time. I think it's a kal v'chomer to a terrorist who's perhaps coming on his own, pressured into it by Hamas, whoever sent him. He's clearly not doing tshuva. It could happen, but in jail, usually they become more hardened in their beliefs. He's dangerous now. He's dangerous in jail. He's certainly dangerous when he gets out. And in theory...
So let's go. According to Rashi, a Chevy, you cannot kill.
You should not. It doesn't say can't, but he says chidarkecha. Is it the proper way?
I understand. So it would seem that you can't.
Right.
It would be right. And the Rambam who says you can kill is talking by a Mohammed's mitzvah.
Even Mohammed's Rishus, he's talking about both. The beginning of this parak talks about both Mohammed's Rishus and Mohammed's mitzvah. You have to sue for peace by both.
I understand that, but the permission to kill or the chiyuv to kill would be by Mohammed's mitzvah.
No, because the Rambam says Rishus, because the next line, he says, then when it comes to Mohammed's mitzvah, like Amalek and Zion Amim, he explains different
details. I understand,
details.
But once the Mohammed is over, you shouldn't have a right to kill according to the Rambam either.
It doesn't sound like that. The Rambam,
what would be the
heta? The heta would be is that
the Mohammed is over.
I would assume no country enjoys being conquered, and if there's a sizable force left, they would not take it sitting down, and they'd be back for a counterattack. That's the assumption.
Does that say that, though?
It doesn't say that, but the Rambam isn't Mohalek. The Rambam just says... In Lo Shlima, this talking about Mechavis Rishus also. Eisenim Mechama V'Hargin Kol Zacharim Agadolim, which Kol Zacharim might mean whoever you need to eliminate.
I mean, the Rambam says Osin Imoe Mechama. So he's talking about during the act of
right,
war.
Right, but why does he have to add what's Hargin Kol Zacharim Agadolim? It's obvious whoever comes to shoot you, you kill.
Right.
So what's the Rambam being Marpa? The Mashmos of the Rambam
after
is...
After the surrender?
This is the debatable point. I'm just bringing it up for a possibility. But clearly in the Navi, you have a Machlokes, the Radak, the Metzudas, seemingly against Rashi and the Rabag, what the fallback position. I don't believe there's a real argument. It's just like Elisha Paskin that if it makes sense for peace, for the greater peace, to let them go and give them food and give them a wonderful farewell, then do so. The practical question over here is, unfortunately, we're not even fighting an army. We're not fighting a people that if there were a truce, they would listen to it. You have an individual who is clearly out Lahashmet al-Arig. There's no chance that, or very little chance, he's going to do tshuva in the process. He's dangerous, and...
So would you say, so one hand you're saying it's a Mohammed or is it Al-Trodev?
It's Al-Trodev. There's a general Mohammed going on.
So let's go through one. If he's a Rodev, when he's incapacitated, he's not a Rodev anymore.
Yes, but they're going to patch him up, send him to the hospital, work on him for the $100,000 surgery you mentioned, and they're going to put him back together.
So for example, do we know that once a Rodev, always a Rodev?
If it's a crime of passion, a one-time thing, a guy's a nice guy, then of course not. If it's a person who says his existence is to eliminate the enemy.
So let me ask you a question. Let's say you have Shimon and Reuven and Shimon. Mm-hmm. And Reuven does a heinous act against Shimon. He steals his wife, his money, and his children. Mm-hmm. And Shimon tries to kill Reuven. He says, he stole my wife, my money, and my children. And they stop Shimon. And he says, I'm going to get Reuven. He stole my wife, my money, and my children. And he tries to kill him, and they incapacitate him. Would you say... You could kill him whenever you want because you know he's going to come back and kill you because he said he's going to kill you and he's so angry, you know he's going to come back. Would you say he has a chazak of a rodef and you could kill him?
For the guy who's normally from Yerei Shemayim, but it's a crime of passion because he's angry.
And he has a good reason,
to be angry.
To be angry and stay angry.
But there's who to talk to. It's not that he hated the guy for the last 50 years.
Well, he hates him. He took his wife
now
for
he
his
does.
Child children.
Now he does. The
Would
answer,
you say
no,
he's a...
No. The answer is no, because as it's, I'll say it, Barem is, there's a chazaka of a b'machshava. an Akum b'machshav already gets debited ke'ilu v'dan, and a Yid not.
I understand.
So that tip comes into play also. Again, in theory, but this is thus far just pointing out, there are sources in Tanakh and the Rambam for this. I would like to add one very important caveat, and that is that we're still in Gullus. We're in Eretz Yisrael in Gullus. Rabbi Yaakov and Chumash says that the whole Bayis Sheni, they were in Eretz Yisrael, but it was really just a booster shot to get them through the rest of Gullus.
Right.
People can't lose sight of that. We have to be concerned what the Umas Olam say. If it's a net loss, if they're going to think, or even if we're going to be accused of eliminating somebody when he was already down and out, and that will ultimately cost more lives, per the discussion last week with the Harab Bayis issue, whether you can go there, you can't. We hold you shouldn't. But even if you hold you should, you have to look at the greater picture. And part of the general machlekes in that department is the time we live in. Is it ikfas and mashiach, or is it aschalta de gula? It sounds like semantics, but it's a huge difference. If you hold it as aschalta de gula, like many in that camp hold, you have to fight for every inch, harabais included. And this is a mechametz mitzvah, and people die, but it's a mechama. Most of our gedolim held that it was ikfas and mashiach. We hope it's aschalta de gula, but who knows? And we can't paskan shailism, put lives on the line for that. Same thing over here. People might feel as a gut reaction, get rid of them, and they're all reitzchim, and they're all potential reitzchim, and get rid of them. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not, but if international opinion, international fury won't support that and will cause more of a negative impact overall, then
and let me add on to what you're saying. What's problematic is that the Magen Avraham, I think it's in Reish Mem Dalet, says that if we're not allowed to build a shul outside the tchum on Shabbos, even though there's no shaila of marasayin because it's outside the tchum, and the Magen Avraham says, he says, because since the Umay Sa'ilam don't build their knesias on their Yom Edom, they shouldn't say, oh, look, they're worse than us.
That's right.
So if we assume that Chazal's opinion of Harigas in Mulchama is more lenient than them, then they will say, look, they don't abide by the Geneva Convention, and we do, and that itself, according to the Magen Avraham, becomes a Chilul Hashem.
Right, it's a Chilul Hashem, and it's dangerous, because if at the end of the day it's going to be a backlash, we could be 100% right on all the issues. If it's going to be a bigger backlash, we have to now look in Gullus conditions, and not necessarily what's right and wrong, but what will work to save the most lives. We're not in the Gula yet, and we don't have the plates to declare that it's a Mechama, and therefore we have to
So Ravina, you would say halachically there would be room to allow it, theoretically.
And I think the White House thinks there's room to allow it.
Yes, but in the Olam HaSiyah, you're rather more skeptical.
I think it's too dangerous, and I think that they send out their friends to film what's going on during the stabbing.
So you say it's basically halacha, but ain't Meirin Kain.
More than very American. I think we have to be mirror that we have to now. It might not be covered by the Geneva Convention. They're not actually the enemy combatants not in uniform with a flag with a country.
Right.
The law is not clear whether we're more mekel or more machmir.
So you're saying we have to be more stringent than the White House?
Yes.
I'll give you
a second example. It's clear from halacha, from all of Navi and all of Rambam, that when a person wins a battle, they take the booty. The money goes to the victor. That was true in the ancient world till about 100 years ago.
Well,
today, nobody does it. So you can't do it. Even though halachically you have a right, if somebody came certainly to kill you and we moved into Lebanon to defend ourselves and somebody dropped a watch, the international law now is you can't take booty. Even though halacha clearly says that it would have been okay if they're being more strict on this issue, it would be a chilul Hashem, and it can get dangerous if we're not fighting the war, even though it's very unfair and our enemies are not fighting the war according to these conventional rules. We have to.
There you heard it. That's Rabbi Yosef Weiner, noted Paisik, Mechaber of Svarim, 800 Shiurim online. Thank you very much for joining us,
Thank
Rabbi
you,
Weiner.
And hopefully these Shailas will be Halacha V'lo L'maisa. Thank you very much.
We have the honor of having on the phone with us from Yerushalayim, Harav HaGoyin Rav Nachum Eisenstein, who is the Mishamish by Rav Yashiv for 30 years, and sat by his side and wrote and listened. Welcome, Rav Nachum.
Welcome, Yedidi Rav David.
So, before we get to our main conversation, Rav Nachum, let me ask you a sidebar. Do you believe that somebody who goes up to the Har HaBayis today is a Roidif?
It's a political question. I can just tell you that Rav Yosef, from a halacha aspect, was very, very bothered by this people going to Har HaBayis. And I was there several times when he told people that we should collect money and set up a fund to have people standing by the entrance of the Har HaBayis and giving out flyers, warning them how serious of a violation it is to go into the Har HaBayis. Anything more than that is political. We just know that the Gemara says that that we should not fight the Umas. We should not fight the nations by force. It's one of the Shvuas, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us that we cannot fight by force. It's not the way to win with the Arabs. We have to know we're dealing with this week's parsha or last week's parsha of Lech Lecha, that Huya Para Adam, the Ishmael, was a para. He wasn't Adam, the Mepharshim say. He was a para. He was a wild animal that looked like an Adam, and the Chafetz Chaim already warned that the problems we're going to have from the Arabs are indescribable, and it's going to be worse than anything else in history. So to say that this is the cause might be a catalyst, but the problems of the Arabs, which they want to eradicate the Jews, is a problem which is tested in history from the time the Torah was given.
I understand, but my question is that since there seems to be almost a direct correlation, somebody goes up to the Har HaBayis, they stab somebody. So does that mean that you are a gram of a Ritzicha when you go up? Assuming you're going up to a place that there's no Shaila, they hold that it's Mutter, it's not like the Kafta V'Ferach, it's not the Har HaBayis, but would that be a gram Ritzicha? And it's, Moshe, the Ramos says in Shin Peches that a counterfeiter has a din of a roidif, and you give him over to the authorities, but because of him, he endangers others. So would you put the equivalent a ruling to somebody who goes up to the Har HaBayis?
The comparison to the Ramos is not a comparison, because there, if you pass on a counterfeit bill, and that person is going to be caught with a counterfeit bill in the time of Shulchan Aruch, especially with a Jew, that person was tantamount, the person was going to be arrested and probably killed. So there was a direct possibility of a damage being caused to a person because he gave him something which he would be caught with it, with counterband and counterfeit, it was very likely he would be killed. Over here, it's only a grammar. It's only a grammar. There's a lot of other grammars also. So to say from a halakhic standpoint that it's also, and he called to someone to din Torah, that he was goyim, that someone, chas v'shalom, should be killed, is in my base, and I don't think I would be mechayiv him, not even in grammar, lotus l'day shemayim. However, there's no question about it that we're not interested today in starting up. We have to live a peaceful life. We have to live a coexistence over here. That's the G'dayli Yisrael, which I had discussed to being Mishamish. That was their policy also. And I think there's nothing to discuss as far as the Har HaBayis. It's an Issa Chomer. And if we're Zoyche, that the Reish Memshala, the Netanyahu, that he's asking people not to go to Har HaBayis, and whatever the reason is, but we could save whoever listens to him not to go to Har HaBayis and to be prevented from being over in Issa Chorus. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu has his ways of trying to help people. And this is a Revach Vatzala Yehudim Shabam HaMachem Acher.
So let's talk about, Ramachem, about the issue of Hafgas Kiddushin. Talk to me about it, and what do you think about the recent case in America?
So we all know that Rav Yosef was very, very against Hafgas Kiddushin. Rav Yosef took the serious of the issue of Eishes Ish very, very seriously. I mean, people can learn yeshivas many years and learn about Eishes Ish and about Chorus, about Nisachomer, but when it comes to practical issues, they seem to forget about all the chumras which the Chazal placed upon ourselves when it comes to a matter and Eishes Ish. And what I heard from Rav Yosef, clearly that he feels that really no one has the right to make Havkalas Kedushin today. If there would be a possibility to make Havkalas Kedushin, he said maybe Rav Moshe, who's the Gadol Hador, Rav Moshe Feinstein, was the Gadol Hador, then maybe he would be authoritative to do a Havkalas Kedushin. But again, everything has to be transparent. Psakim have to come out. If there is a psakim, there is a machlekes, that it's, everything has to be transparent. Everything has to be investigated with a proper basedin. Rav Yosef held if there wasn't a basedin kavua v'choshev, a proper basedin talmidei chachamim that investigated the situation b'fanav. B'fanav means that the baldover, the wife and the husband appeared in front of the basedin. I always tell everyone when we learned in cheder that fourth grade or in fifth grade that the person is not allowed to mekabel edus to receive edus unless in front of the people, and any edus which is shloi b'fnei baldinoi due to the circumstances that some of the parties do not want to come, so it has limited nemanus. There's a Neidib Yehuda which discusses it, there's a Pisgah Tshuva which discusses it, but to go as far as to make Havkalas Kedushin without a proper basedin, that's one I think it's impossible. Halachically, it's not possible. And even if in a special case that Havkalas Kedushin would be possible, Rav Yosef held it has to be done, but only maybe Rav Moshe by the Gdolei Hador. But in the regular case, Havkalas Kedushin is not a solution. It's not a solution to the general problem of agunas. If there is a specific and special case with a special situation, the Le'aleinu, we don't have a Pesach Hador anymore in America, or even in the whole world as far as that goes, and Rav Moshe is not here. So I assume that the Gdolei Hador have to sit together in a very serious way, in a very transparent way, to discuss all the issues, and then decide if there's a possibility of Havkalas Kedushin. But things which are done secretly, without transparency, I think that there's nothing to discuss.
So
to answer your question now, what I think about it, I can't say what I think about it because I don't have the documents. I don't have what the Masav Matan was. What this godless Gdolei Yisrael involved, as I understand. I'm sure each one has their reasons, but it has to be transparent. Yosef all uses to quote. When something like this happened, there's a machlekes and a serious issue of Eishazish. He used to quote the Cleves get. 250 years ago, there was a machlekes over a get.
Famous Cleves get, yeah.
From a Choshva family in Cleves, which was a city, I think, in Germany. And all the Gdolei Yisrael at that time got involved. And they even printed a whole kuntris, I think it's called
Ol
Yesharim, which just has all the... It has all the tshuvas in a transparent way from the Gdolei Yisrael then who were involved, and then it's each person has to decide what he has to do. It was a very pleasant outcome from the Cleves get that after they were fighting and all the
Gdolei Yisrael. They got back together. The rumor has it.
They got back together again. So it's that was the Goyim to Shalom Bayis, or the Lachse Grushasa. So maybe the whole Machlekes in Cleves to save one family maybe was in Cleves. The Cleves get sets a precedent that if there is a Machlekes and the question there was a based in there which gave a psak and one based one against another psak, everything has to be transparent. And it's and then the Gdolei Yisrael, who am I or us that we should mix into what the Gdolei Yisrael said? But as long as there's no transparency from Gdolei Yisrael, and there's a Cheskas Eishasish, and there's a Psach from a Basin. A psak from a basin, which is in American standards considered a chosh of a basin, I think that the cheskes kama from Eishas Eish remains.
So, are you so the get that was quote unquote Havkalas Kedushin that was done in Memphis on this woman Epstein? Have you seen any halachic writing about it at all, or no?
Absolutely not. I'm here in Eretz Yisrael. Maybe in America there's things going around. I usually am in contact with the Rabbanim and all of these things. I haven't seen anything. If you saw something, L'Hagdil Ter L'Adir, Reb David, that I'd appreciate if you would send it to me.
Well, I spoke to Rabbi Greenblatt. I spoke to Rabbi Greenblatt, and all he would say is, he says, I've been a Rav for 60 years. He says, I've only done it twice, Hafgas Kedushin, and this is one of the two situations, but I don't want to discuss it. That's all he would say. So let me.
All I can tell you, I have a lot of respect for Rabbi Greenblatt. And I'm in contact with him, not on a daily basis, but we're in contact over issues of Gittin, of Geirus, of other things which we're involved with. And you should know the Rabbi Greenblatt, I consider from the daily America. He's a person, he makes a very tzenuotic impression, but he's a Talmud Chochem, he's a Yodeya B'chol Mochem, you can talk to him all over. And and he's a person that I have a lot of respect for, and I don't understand. I'm surprised is not the way. I just don't understand what's going on over here. And again, I think that transparency will be the answer to everything.
Well, I would just say, not knowing anything, it's very likely that rather than Hafkoas Kedushin, it's more likely Mekach Toyes. And Mekach Toyes is very situation. I mean, if the guy was a transvestite, right? I mean, it would be very highly personal, et cetera. And I can understand why the Rav would say, you know, I don't want to get into the personal details of why it was a Mekach Toyes.
Okay, again, I'm not even saying that would be a reason for Afkos Kedushin.
It wouldn't be Afkos Kedushin, it would be Mekach Toyes.
Even would be Mekach Toyes. That they were living together, the way I understand, they were living together as a child together, and if this was a situation which came up afterwards, then I don't think there will be a makom for Mekach Toyes. But again, I'm not a person to mix in between the right. To the Horim Magdalim, the big mountains, the Gdali Yisrael. And again, I consider I'm not a Greenblatt from the Gdali Apoiskim in America.
Let me ask you a different question. What is your opinion of the prenuptials that the RCA and many Rabbanim, Rabbi Asher Weiss gave Haskam on? What is your opinion of them?
So my opinion is in writing that since the prenuptial issue came up again in Eretz Yisrael and they wanted to pass it as a law that every marriage here has to include a prenuptial. Rav Yosef was against the prenuptials. He sent me many times I should give over his opinion that he was against any type of a prenuptial for two reasons. One is that he held that there's a halachic problem that it might be in a smachta, and secondly,
there's eitzes for a smachta. You could do if they're based in Yosef. There are solutions for a smachta.
Okay, in the based in Choshev and then a couple
right, so there are solutions for us.
He held also that might help for the few times, not when you sign and you don't know what you're signing on. But again, it's not the place to go into. And I'm just telling you, in principally speaking, he held one is Nasmachta, and two is that that's not the derech of Yisrael Saber. That at the time of the marriage, you already talk about a divorce. That's not the way Kedushin is done, be Kedusha Vatara. Ma'agav, there's other people. There's other people you're speaking about, of course, Kedushin and the Guna problem. There are other people who want to give an Eitzah that we should make sure there should be Psuli Eidim at the Chasna.
Yeah, but then you have your Biyasa, Biyaznus. What kind of stupid Eitzah is that?
They want to stop.
But that's not a solution. That's a Purim solution. That's an ignorant solution. But this is the Nesivis.
Okay.
But the Nesivis already gives this solution.
Okay, so I see you agree for we. But again, one of the other reasons why Yosef was against it, because he was against doing something, not to make a proper Kedushin, because maybe that'll solve the Guna problem. Today, someone's getting married, we have to do it Kedash. Most of Yisrael. Agav,
respectfully, Ramachem, the Ksuba was Shalaita Kalabain of Haitziah. Chazal built in a prenuptial, right?
No, it's just the opposite. The prenuptial is to force a husband, to pressure him to give a get.
But my point is, Chazal already at the time of the wedding, Chazal already are anticipating what happens if something goes wrong,
and how do we
fix it now? So it's not a new problem.
But the purpose of the ksuva is not to divorce your wife. The purpose of the ksuva is trying to work in shalom bayis.
Well, a prenuptial does the same thing. You can't be ma'agin her. If you can't be ma'agin her, maybe you'll try to work things out, right?
No. The purpose of the prenuptial is that in order not to get a knas, so you won't hold back the get, and you'll give her a get in Shalom al Yisrael. So the purpose of the prenuptial is just the opposite of what the purpose of a ksuva is.
Well, it's not. It's to try to create a dialogue.
It's not to try to create a dialogue. It's trying to put pressure on the husband to give a get.
So can I ask you, so it's the chash, he held at the chash of just sort of changing the methodology of the attitude of Kiddushin? Was that basically, that was Rebbe Yashiv's opposition to it?
It's not the way Kiddushin is done. B'nusach Yisrael Sakh.
So can I just... But let me ask you a question. It's one of the most sore thumbs, you know, it's in the press constantly. It's an embarrassment to our community. It's been in the Post and in the Times. Rabbanim going to jail. Your good friend Mati Walmark from the Mir is going to jail for this now. It's been in the Journal, in the Times, on TV. I mean,
please don't jump the gun. I was still being mispalal.
Okay,
but my
point is, at what point do we say we have to face the problem? I mean, Times.
Let me just 2 points, just to finish the first point about prenuptial. Then we'll speak about the Aguna problem. I mean, as far as prenuptial, I have this chus of speaking personally and privately with the Goyner of David Feinstein. And last month and last summer when he was in Eretz Yisrael, and I met with him privately and spoke to him by Riches Gedoyle, which is by Rav David. That's every minute it's a chus. Just like Rav Yashav, every minute was a schus, and Rav David is not a person, it's a marich, and he gave me full permission in front of Edom, that I should and I can't be mafarsim, and I should publicize in his name that Moshe was against all prenuptials. So as far as that, there's a consensus of daily
but was
Rav
Moshe halachically or hashkafically or halachically?
He told me both. When I asked him this question, he told me both. That's the word he told me. Rav David, I speak in English, and when I asked him this question, the answer was both.
Okay.
So just let me discuss for one minute the Aguna problem.
Yeah.
The Aguna problem is an issue which has to be dealt with, but and unfortunately, as a Rav, I have to deal with a lot of getting cases, lav dafka in my kehila, but people come to me from all over for guidance in this issue, and das Torah and clarity, things which I received from being Mashamish Rav Yashiv, like you mentioned, over 30 years. The Aguna problem is totally out of proportion. There are a few crazy husbands that they take nekama against their wives for no reason, nekama l'shem nekama, and they'll withhold a get for any reason whatsoever. And I've dealt with several of these cases. I can't say a lot. But many, and I would say even most of the Aguna cases, are caused because there's ladies' organizations, lawyers, kruma bala etza, who give etzas to ladies to make fights, to make demands for things which they don't want, to go to court instead of going to Beis Din, and the courts are usually against the men, to take away the children from the men for no halachic reason, and they fight with the men in such a way that the men get frustrated and they fight back. It would work from day one. From day one, I can tell you, almost every case which I had, every divorce case, which I could not work in Shalom Bayis, and I will not get involved in the get unless they put all the effort possible into Shalom Bayis. I come out every case I was able to solve. cases which came to me afterwards, after there was fights, after the lawyers got involved, the courts got involved, the ladies' organizations got involved, that it was very, very hard to deal with them because the husband was so frustrated, and you put him into a melchama that he's fighting, and he'll fight for the end of Maisa Thomas Nafshi and Plishtin. And the one, and I'm not afraid to say this in public, that I think that a big responsibility, a cause for the Guna situation, is these ladies' organization, the courts, the lawyers, and the Balia Eitzah, who don't know how to make a get b'shalom.
Well, thank you very much, Rafa Goyin, Reb Nachum Eisenstein, the Mishamish Bakoidesh, the assistant. He wrote, he gave over the Chuvis Rebel Yashu for over 30 years, the Rav, Raj Bezdin. Thank you very much. We hope we would have the honor of having you on another occasion as well. Well, that was a great interview. Coming up, we're going to have some amazing. We have Rebbe David Yosef, who is the son of Harav HaGoyin, the Rashke Bahagavar of all the Sfaradim and the Goyla, and certainly of maybe all of Klal Yisrael, Rabbi Avadya Yosef, the prolific author, and in my humble opinion, perhaps the most influential Sfaradish Rav since the Rambam. I mean, what an impact. Who wrote a tshuva that saved 100,000 lives? A quiz. There's only two that I could think of, and one is Rabbi Avadya Yosef, who penned the tshuva that saved all of Ethiopian Jewry. Operation Red Carpet, when he said, based according to the Radvaz, that they have a Din Yisrael, he saved all of Ethiopian Jewry. So we're going to have his son, who has written over 25 Sfarim on the program. First time that this great Sfaradish Rav has ever been on in Eretz Yisrael. What an incredible honor. And I'm going to ask him to talk about segregation in schools that we know, sadly, in Eretz Yisrael, it's a real topic where, based upon the color of your skin, they decide whether they'll accept you in a school or not. And it's, sadly, not unlike what's happening in America today. They have that happening in Eretz Yisrael as well. I also want to discuss with, I want to get the opinion of our listenership, with all these stories of molestation, etc., why don't we have cameras in classrooms? What do we have to worry about? Why would an honest teacher be opposed to having a camera in the classroom? I see only somebody who has something to hide should be upset about it. They should demand, and I'll tell you something more, the teacher should demand it. Any teacher at any time could be accused and be sued by a three-year-old could ruin a teacher's career. If I were a teacher, I would say, I won't teach without a camera in my classroom. I'm for cameras in classroom, cameras in Bahersherim. In today's age, there's no reason why we shouldn't have. Now, it's not saying you have to listen in. Maybe it should be without sound. If you have an opinion on that, I look forward to speaking to you next week. This is David Lichtenstein's for Headlines Radio, bringing you the most cutting-edge topics with the most prominent Rabbanim, the smartest, the wisest, most cutting-edge guests. See you next week. Thank you.